I talked to you about Toynbee, and there's no way I'm ready to do Toynbee. So I started looking at how much I have to do yet, and I don't want to rush through it. So what I'm going to propose for next time, if you agree, is this book, Windows on Eternity. I'm going to pass it around, have a quick look on it. I know some of you wanted to do it anyway. It's beautiful. It's 50 bucks, and the pictures are magnificent. It's the work of a Swiss artist, Peter Burkhäuser, and he worked with Jung. His daughter is an analyst. She must be about my age. I think she's born a year after me. And she wrote the book. So it's an interpretation of his pictures. And I'll put them up on the screen, and then we'll just talk about it. And then Von Franz, yeah. I think he worked with Jung until Jung's death, and then he worked with Von Franz.
So there's Jungian interpretation going?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And my colleague who worked on the Red Book, John Peck, said it's the best Jungian book since Jung. And I tend to agree with him. If it's not the best, it's one of the best. It is so thoughtful. And she's writing about her father, who had problems, and also an enormous creativity. And her work is just, this is what Jungian therapy is supposed to be about. Mm-hmm. So much worry today. Oh, my God, don't tell me. We call this Jungian work. But that is a nice piece of work. So I think we'll enjoy it, and it'll be very informative. So that's my proposal. And you want to get it ahead of time, and it's 50 bucks on Amazon, which is a steal, because the pictures are great. They must have had a foundation that supported the publication.
The pictures are so much better than that than the other book. The first book that came out.
And actually I have two videos of lectures by Dean France on It's interesting, just as a complete detail, that's how I got in Indianapolis. I don't even know that story. But I was in Zurich, and I was writing my thesis on scientific creativity, so I read Dean France's thesis. Dean France, who just died recently, he was up in Fort Wayne. He wrote his thesis on Burkhäuser, whom I'd never heard of before I met Dean. And I saw him one day, about a year before I graduated. He had come back. He graduated about 6 years before me. And I flagged him down, and I said, I just read your thesis, and I'm working on creativity. How about a cup of coffee? So we just sat at a cafe and chatted. And he had said, well, where are you going to go when you graduate? And I said, I don't have a clue. And he said, well, why don't you come look at Indianapolis? Because I'm in Fort Wayne. I've been commuting here. I'm 60-some, and it's getting me too much. So it's funny how these things interweave.
What happened to all the paintings?
Well, most of them are still apparently in his studio.
Dean France had a bunch of them.
Oh, of slides?
No, he had the actual paintings.
I don't think he had paintings.
Didn't he donate them to Houston?
Houston, yeah. He had slides and paintings. As far as I know, he didn't have any paintings.
Do you remember when he came here, he talked about there was no one would take them, and he took a bunch of them?
Yeah, that's slides, I think.
I thought he was talking about paintings, because he was talking about no museum taking them.
I don't think he... as far as I know, a few were sold, but, some artists don't like to get rid of their work.
Really?
Yeah.
We don't know where that is.
So I think they're still in his little studio in Basel, as far as I know. And apparently, he painted a lot more than were in that book, because Dean chose a bunch. But Dean's pictures, by comparison, were okay. These are superb. I mean, Dean just took a 35 millimeter at the studio, and you know what? You don't get a good shot like that. So that's my proposal. Okay. And I don't know how long it'll take, but we're moving along, although this chapter is quite deep. But we only have about, what have we got, 50 pages to go? So we're doing 10 to 20 pages a week. Although this is tough material. Okay. Well, now it gets a bit dry, maybe, but what she does is simply look at how this idea of first the genius Loki, then the immortal spiritual psychic nucleus has developed throughout history. And what each one adds to the idea of this, what we're calling the self, and then how this idea of the self has evolved, and then what we have lost in our contemporary descriptions in religion of what Jung would call the self. So, Stoics, last paragraph 147. Stoics taught the existence of such a daimon in double form. One is a divine component of the psyche, nous. The other is a spark of the fiery world soul that has migrated into human beings. This latter daimon, or this part of the daimon, guides a man from without through his whole life. So you get, first of all, you get an overlap of the inner daimon and an outer force. And you also get the emphasis on the idea of a guide. I think if there's one word you can use to describe the conscious self, it's guide. It's the inner guide. Through your professional development, through your personal development, through your relationships, and so on.
But it also sounds like once the Greeks got a hold of it, I mean, you know, the body has started to fall out.
It slowly falls away.
Which is the same thing with Christianity.
Right. Plutarch emphasizes that the ability to relate to this figure is dependent on the purity of the person who's seeking to find it. And that we find in Jung's idea that the self and the ego are compensatory. If you don't care about it, it won't care about you. It's a hard lesson to learn. And again, he mentions the guide. With the Neoplatonists, now they're guys that about 200 or 300 years after, about 700 years after Plato, who revived Platonic ideas in the Roman and Hellenistic period. This genius became immortal. See how it's slowly evolving toward a spiritual reality versus a fun-loving spirit. And she mentions on 148, five lines down, as you referred to, Kate, it slowly loses its connection with the body. A new idea that enters at this time, which I think is really, again, central to Jung's idea of the self, and again, as far as I know, nobody else talks like this, is that this inner daimon is connected to fate. In other words, the idea, which is so important for Jung, is that identity is inborn. Your life story is inborn. Your life plan is inborn. So that the self would be that pattern and the guidance to fulfill that pattern. That's all in the business of the self. It's almost like a sort of inner astrology. That Jung felt astrology was a projection of the self onto the stars.
So here's where she talks about the daimon surpassing the idea of the genius or the Juno, incorporating masculine and feminine.
Where is that?
Yeah,
can you read it to us? At the bottom?
Italicized.
Yeah. Now, it's a little confusing to me here. She talks about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines up, the daimon knows the future.
Yeah.
Now, is she referring back to that four-part daimon of Macrobius here?
Let me think here. Yeah, of a particular... let me read that. But Macrobius, he's about, what, 3rd century, I think, described...
He's Greek.
Roman, I would imagine, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Apparently, it's sort of like the Roman version, if I correctly understand, the Roman version of the Symposium. A bunch of guys get together on Saturnalia, which is, you know, the darkest night of the year, December 21st, and have a talk, and so he writes up their conversation. In his view, every human being is a combination of four daimons, of Eros, as we have become acquainted with him, of a particular destiny, a fate ordained by the god, of a daimon whose nature is stamped by the position of the sun in the horoscope. Well, I guess that's just two, isn't it? He doesn't really spell it all for
us. And then Tyche, fortune.
I think that's kind of the same as fate.
Well, the one's the position of the sun, one has to do with the position of the moon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And then they say the daimon. Now, is she referring back there to Macrobius' daimon?
Yes, I would think so.
Knows the future.
Yeah.
In him, masculine and feminine are merged. So yeah. This is that evolution of Juno that I'm talking about.
A higher teleological knowledge? How would you describe
it? I don't know yet how to describe it. I'm just sort of groping around.
Well, maybe you'll paint a painting of
it. It's no longer merely genius or Juno, but an archetypal image that, like the lapis in alchemy, unites the alchemists in one figure.
Yes, a hermaphrodite?
Yes, I guess that would be the hermaphrodite. So happens like that.
Oh. See, the illustrations are all
exactly. Now, see, this figure is hermaphroditic. It's in the series. Well, it's not revealed. But it is. It always was hermaphroditic.
In your mind, huh?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But it seems to me that you would be seeing, I mean, in art I'm seeing that, I would say.
What do you see that, is it, in art? Like what kinds of things you see?
Oh, wow. Well, I suppose you'd have to describe them somewhat alchemically. I'd have to bring something in. I'll try and find something good to bring in.
Maybe this is your work to do. To work on this cow.
I don't know. I'm just groping around here. I'm not.
Well, join the gropers.
Down.
Yeah, this is the way we just. I didn't mean it the way it sounds.
All right, I'm avoiding groping.
Well, so somebody said, "What are you doing Saturday mornings?" Oh, I grope.
We're putting the body back into it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any way we can.
I'm serious. This is the way. We discover things by facing the confusion and then just stay with it and try to express it, either in painting or in words.
From the Hellenistic time, in the Louvre, but it was on the Pompeii, one of the Pompeii exhibits that I saw. Is it a sculpture?
Yeah.
There were a lot of hermaphroditic sculptures
in that day.
But that's the only one I saw. Yeah, I mean, there's so many of them.
And like I
Really,
I Aphrodite sculptures.
I looked them up. But that was unusual because on one when you in the original when you came up on it, you saw that her back, his back, and then you walked around and you saw both breasts and breasts.
In the back you think it's
a woman.
Mm-hmm. So Macrobius Daimon is how does he say it? No longer merely one-sided. So this Macrobius Daimon is more evolved, more evolved image. Is that what she's saying?
Yeah. I think I'd rephrase it a bit for you. Certainly extensive work on the nature of the feminine self is lacking in our field. The image of the feminine self must be developing. Why not make that an object of inquiry? And present it either in image or in lecture. I don't think we have an answer. But so, you know, most of the work that's been published is about the masculine self. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very relevant question with, you know, personal and social implications.
Has that work started somewhat with Esther Harding?
There's some Esther Harding.
Does Esther Harding give any images of her clients at the time that relate to her thoughts? Or doesn't she go back in history mostly?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you could read her work and tell us.
I think I have. I'm thinking, is that how you remember it?
The work that I've read has not been very much, it has not been about images so much as the...
Oh, you haven't seen the one with all the...
I have not. The one with a lot of images. Okay. The ones that I've read have been more about how women, the tracks of their lives and how they are changing.
It's more about female behavior.
Yeah, maybe.
You could say that, yeah.
And read all her works and pluck out all the dreams she presents of the self in women and give a talk on it.
Although, once again, if we go to Harding, that's more historical, too.
Yeah, or then compare it with your experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're ripe for a discussion here.
There's a Japanese union woman who has this book on hand as a symbol of creativity in women. And she draws on current dreams of her.
What's the book?
I think I have it somewhere.
I give
it
that to Kenzie Moore.
It's from a Japanese?
Yeah. I'd be glad to bring it next time.
Yeah, do.
And the fact it starts out with an image of like four or five paintings from one of her analyst fans about hands and how they change.
And she does go back historically.
She does too,
In Japan or the West or both?
A lot of Japanese images of multiple hands in some gods.
I think this is very important stuff.
Yeah.
How many arguments have I sat through on what is the nature of the masculine? What's the nature of the feminine? And nobody says, what's it like in dreams? What is the feminine self like? And to do a cross-cultural intensive study of the self in women's dreams, I think it would be highly valuable. So, thank you, Carol. Apuleius, kind of the same thing. Um, 148, second line of the last paragraph, private patron and individual guide. See, we keep getting that guide bit. That is so important. An observer of what takes place in the inner person, guardian of one's welfare, he who knows one most intimately, one's most alert and constant observer, individual judge, etc.
And yet that has an eye for what's going on outside, too. Not just
right.
The inner person.
Absolutely.
Where they're going in their life and what, how they need to develop to get to the goal.
She says that. Jump ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, because it fits in with something I wanted to say. Well, she says that explicitly somewhere. But keep that in mind. That because what we get to anticipating, she just alludes to it, is the self is both personal and impersonal. Where did she say that? Anyone remember that?
Say it again.
That the self is the most personal and impersonal at the same time.
Is it on the bottom of 149? He was exalted to one symbol of the self in a form, however, in which the collective elements far outweigh.
Well, that's, yeah, thanks. That's one place. But she says it.
Oh, here you go. 153. In the middle of the middle paragraph. Thus,
yes.
That's an extreme paradox.
Thus, an extreme paradox is contained in the symbol itself. It is at once that which is the most intimate, most individual, and at the same time a mirror of total reality as well as a God image, the Anthropos, who embraces all human beings. I think that is so important because that's what I want to work on in training.
Exactly.
How our individual self and how the self, if I can use that word, of history unite. And so that our individual work is at the same time a work on what's going on in history. I just think that work has not yet been done. And I want to try it.
It seems like those four aspects that Macrobius brings in really show how all of those things cross over into the individual. In a way, brings body back by bringing Eros back in.
Yes.
And then who you were ordained to be, that's your fate or destiny.
Yeah.
And then sun and moon, the position of the sun in your horoscope, which would put you in time and space of your time period.
Yes, thank you.
And then fortune is brought in as the moon aspect. I don't know what to make of that right at the moment. I'll have to give that some thought.
Do.
But then this whole idea that all of that contains this spark of the world spirit and then the individual at the same time, all of those crossed over and mixed in together, to me, is what the self is. And what the self is trying to do.
Your head just starts spinning.
I do.
There's so much. Because you can't discuss this self without constantly referring to paradox.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe only with poetry.
Or painting.
Or paintings. Can you grasp it? Because this is below logic. But it is the foundation of, for Jung, the foundation of who we are.
Yeah,
I just
think we have a
change. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between a symbol and a sign? Yeah. Yeah. Woo! Now I forgot where we stopped.
We were on 148.
Were we? Okay.
And 149. Oh, yeah, we were reading about that.
Okay, come back to time and space.
Well, you were reading at the bottom.
Well, I'm going to jump around. Okay. Just the thing you said, I want to emphasize above that. In touch with the world spirit. how this self is personal and not personal. Well, yeah. So that last paragraph, 148, knows one most intimately, one's most alert and constant observer, individual judge. If one watches him in the right way, see him at the bottom, seeks ardently to know him, honors him religiously, then he shows himself to be the one who can see to the bottom of uncertain situations and can give warning in desperate situations, can protect us in dangerous situations, and can come to our rescue when we are in need. He can intervene now through a dream and now through a sign, synchronistic event, or he can even step in by appearing personally in order to fend off evil, to reinforce the good, to lift up the soul in defeat, to steady our inconstancy, to lighten our darkness, to direct what is favorable towards us, and to compensate what is evil. It is well known that in late antiquity, a primitive element of religious experience and the philosophic religious theories was much stronger than in the classic period, perhaps through contact with the more primitive outlying border areas of Greco-Roman culture. I know of scarcely an account from antiquity that gives a better description of the experiences of the self than the short summary of Apuleius. And then we get to the effect of Christianity on the understanding of this daimon. Maybe I'll just read that, because this is all pretty rich stuff. I'm trying to save time, but I got every word in this page on my mind. As in the case of other daimons, this daimon, which embodies the individual, larger, more comprehensive personality, was in late antiquities also like a mountain of the bulk, of which lay in the transpersonal realm of the psyche, extending only a small tip in the human being's personal sphere. With the Christianization of the ancient cultural world, however, it was for the most part the transpersonal aspects which were retained. That's, I think, really important. His aspect as the messenger of the gods being assimilated to the idea of the angels, and the other aspects, that is, the parapsychological knowledge, the vitality and lustfulness of the genius, were attributed to the devil and his tribe. I think that is critical. But a faint intimation of the individuality of this figure lived on in the idea that the individual may have a particular guardian angel or patron saint. So get the idea. How it has changed. And of course, what we're trying to get back to is a fuller grasp of these elements that have been left in the dust heap of history.
If I recall in Greece, you celebrate your birthday not on the day you were born, but it's the birthday of the saint that you're named for.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
That would be the same idea. Mm-hmm. Okay, we got through Greco-Roman. Now we will plunge into the medieval period. Can you stand it? I think that's... Let's see if we missed anything. No, I think we did it. Okay, you okay so far? Getting a feeling for the panorama of what this is trying to represent for us. She then goes to Hermetic philosophy. Hermetic philosophy is based on the text, and she tells it somewhere. Oh, the Corpus Hermeticum. Corpus Hermeticum comes from, I think, about the 2nd or 3rd century in the Hellenistic period. It is a series of texts in which a figure called Hermes speaks. It's somewhat religious, not Christian religious, but what's so interesting is that some of the ideas sound like they are parallel to Christianity, and the reason Jung got so interested in that material was because he felt it showed that what Christianity was doing was picking up a movement in the collective unconscious. So that the shepherd is one of the big images in this Corpus Hermeticum. And so the collective unconscious was a deep collective movement which popped up in Christianity, it popped up in the Corpus Hermeticum, and what we get in the Corpus Hermeticum is, and why it's so, another reason why it's so important, is it shows those aspects of Christianity, those aspects of that movement which surfaced in Christianity, which Christianity eliminated. So it gives us a fuller picture of the religious revival that was trying to happen from within at that time. And so I don't know how many, I think it's like 10 or 15 manuscripts, and one of them is called the Poimandres. And another word for it is the Shepherd of Hermes, I think it's called. And in that, a shepherd speaks. Well, it doesn't say Christ, but it is a shepherd, and Jung used that as an example of an archetype that's surfacing in a couple of places. And he goes into it because by studying the shepherd in that text, he got an idea of a guide that is more fully presented than Christ. So that's why she goes into that. And also, there are texts from that assembly of texts which are thought to be early alchemical recipes. The alchemy started probably from embalming symbolism. Like the alchemist tried to make the body eternal. Later it began trying to make material substance into a higher state, gold or diamonds. So just at this time, the primal mind is working with these ideas, and it shows up too in that text. So that's the background of Hermetic philosophy. And elements that again surface in the description of this daimon are that it has an astrological reference. In an astrological document there at the last paragraph of 150 of the 3rd century, and so on, so that we get this idea of fate.
How did you say Hermes hooks up with astrology?
Is it
an astrological text?
Well, no, this is just that Corpus Hermeticum is just the background of this whole chapter. And here she's just referring to a specific document. That is, I don't think it's in that corpus.
Oh, okay.
It's just, now she's amplifying, she's going all over the place, looking at various traditions, but with the focus primarily on the Corpus Hermeticum. On the shepherd bit and this idea that there's a guiding a guiding voice. She's going back to this text to make the point how other traditions in Middle Ages, well, after antiquity through the Middle Ages, articulated that there is something in us that guides us. That's the basic point. And so she talks about the spirit of truth, and how this alchemist Zosimos, I think these guys were all in Alexandria, worshipped this spirit of truth. Again, true knowledge as a gift of the daimon. Another description of it is that the spirit is a guide in a journey to the underworld. We've heard this before. These are just similar comments from a different historical time. An interesting idea is that middle page. So we're just amplifying. It doesn't have a logical order, but she's circumambulating the various descriptions. This figure, according to another tractate of the Corpus Hermeticum, had sent a mixing bowl full of nous, knowledge of God, down to men and had commanded that their hearts be baptized in it in order to come to God, knowing wherefore it, the heart, had been born. Well, that's Jung's a priori identity. He appears in all things, and especially to whom he wills to appear, so that the self has its own intentionality. Delivers them away from unconsciousness. He will come to you everywhere on your way through life and will reveal himself everywhere, where and when you expect least. Another tractate of the Corpus Hermeticum, Hermes, now on 152. Hermes gives to the pupil an account of his own awakening to a higher consciousness in the following words. After looking within and seeing a formless vision that came to me out of God's mercy, I was lifted out of myself and entered an immortal body, so that I am no longer who I was, but am reborn in the nous. The experience cannot be taught. Thus came the knowledge, gnosis of God to me, and through this act of creation, I have become divine. Again, we're dealing here with an archetype of knowing. I don't know. These are just different examples. Same idea, different texts. I'm trying to pick up the main ideas. The second paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down. Now he follows the will of his father. See where I am there. Second paragraph, 152, 2, 4, 6 lines down. He follows the will of his father. Again, something is directing something else. And the key word, guiding. So you keep coming to this word, up against this word guiding again and again in a variety of contexts. Again, picking out the key. Key ideas. 153. Go down 2, 4, 6, 7 lines down. Who brings plans to fruition? A guiding figure that helps accomplish a, I hate the word higher, but a more profound, maybe, will.
But Gary, like we talked about in Red Book, the self, when you're first experiencing it, is blind, so it may be bringing something higher to fruition, but it can be through just a disaster.
Absolutely. Yeah, she doesn't really talk about the dark side, but certainly, yeah. In other words, that's why I started with the reference back to the previous chapter, that this process, although I have seen it come to people just as a gift with no misery, usually it starts operating when the individual is feeling completely up against the wall. With, you know, a bad relationship or a depression or an untenable erotic situation, that the ego is been thwarted, you know, the person has tried to get what they want or has failed in getting what they wanted, and that seems like an error, but it is often the precondition for the state of being dismantled, and then this process gets going. Yeah. But I've also seen just, I don't know why, but that's the way it is.
One thing that strikes me too with this and later Christianity is there's a sense of, you know, you can become divine, or you are part of divinity, and that kind of.
Yeah. In staying true to this challenge, you change, and you bring value to yourself, to your friends, to your family, to your world that's special. And one way to describe that is divine. You achieve a state of openness and generosity that has been a tribute to the gods. And you stay interesting. I think that's important. Okay, how are we doing? We talked about the paradox there in the middle of that big paragraph on 153. And then the statement we've already discussed, I think, about the lack of texts on the female self from antiquity and I have to really think back on our literature, but I think probably in our field as well. Probably worth reading, since we've talked about it, the prayer on 154. Hail, Mistress of Tartus, I guess that is, which is the underworld, which thou conquerest with light. Hail, sacred brightness of light, coming out of the darkness where you confuse everything with ill-considered counsel. Thou bitch in a virgin's form. Awake, thou needy Mene of the nourishing sun, warder of the subterranean ones, welcoming shining one, rich in skills and high and swift, manly courageous, healing one, providing and caring blood-colored ominous Primo. Primo was, I think, the word used to describe Demeter. Hecate, is it?
I just read it last night, but that's why I wrote it down.
Because they used that word in the Eleusinian Mysteries, too.
Right.
It was referring to Hecate?
Yeah.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, she's both dark and light. That's the point of this passage.
In the footnote, it says, goddess of the Eleusinian mystery symbolizing strength.
Yeah. So Primo's in the underworld, too. A immortal answerer of prayers. I need to go on.
This prayer is the reason I brought this painting today. The very last sentence.
Yeah.
I know thy great and beautiful exalted name is Hori, through whom the heavens light up and the earth drinks and becomes pregnant. So that prayer told me something about this work.
Yeah.
That I didn't really think of it in that way. You know, the moon goddess or the moon is providing moisture, which the earth drinks and then becomes pregnant. So that told me a little something about that image. What's the name of that? Groundwater?
Yeah, you want to say something?
I was going to say, you know, it's light or knowledge or spirit that somehow penetrates the earth. So it's that combination of the opposite again in that figure that I'm sort of feeling around about.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea is that the most important thing is living the life that this daimon provides a goal in.
That's the pregnancy of
the earth. So that, I don't know, it's hard for me to express, but it's not just that we try to live in life, but that we try to live what the self wants us to live in life. And when we do that, things change. It's almost like time and space change. Because you're not just trying to get done what you want to get done. You're trying to get done what a deeper force working through you wants to get done. And this is, again, this history stuff. And that is, in the deepest work, what the historical moment needs. So it's like the historical, what the historical moment needs comes through you. And that's a pregnancy. And that creates a result bigger than any purely conscious plan could ever accomplish. I think that's the pregnancy. And that's why they keep using these words, divinity and fate and so on. Another dimension of effectiveness enters into your life.
You say time and space change. You're talking about that personally because you're kind of in touch with some eternal.
Yeah.
You live in that moment of kind of the eternal.
Well, yeah, that you have a moment of the eternal. Mm-hmm. And there's an effectiveness that occurs, which doesn't occur when you just do something out of your own wishing. And that these are singularities. It's sort of like the historical moment and your moment converge. And that's, I think that must have struck Jung, and why he spent so much time trying to figure what's going on? What's the nature of reality? And what's the nature of psychology that this can happen? It's not some great woo-woo thing. It's just at certain moments, effectiveness seems to work differently. In a way that almost leaves you scratching your head. Okay. we've heard a lot of this stuff, so I'm not sure we need to go through it again. It's just hearing from different traditions pretty much the same idea. But one idea I think that is well put, which we've said before, but still well put, on page 155, going down 2, 4, 6, 8 lines. Thou sendest holy longing. That's what I was trying to get at, how Eros can be the vehicle for the self. And we're given certain experiences as certain erotic certain erotic experiences because the self is trying to work its way into our life through them. There you can see how Jung and Freud shared a common view and differed. Both take Eros as central. Jung sees it as a portal, very often as a portal. It might be worth reading this last paragraph in light of our... Well, it's 11:30. We'll pick up maybe with that last paragraph because I think in a way it will address Carol's question. Or if not address it, at least explicate it or widen it. So we almost got through this chapter. And why don't you read the next one? Chapter 8. And we'll pick up there with what she's driving at is how this the representation of the female daimon or feminine daimon is much more morally complex than the masculine one. Maybe because the feminine has been seen in only one of its manifestations. Can you get through the rest of the day?
It may be hard.
Thank you for hanging in there.